Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine.
And let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone. Running far, far from home, till I am but skin and bone. I don't wanna die, but I'll have to try. Oh, I don't wanna die, but I'm on my own. Hello, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome back to the pod.
We're here.
See, we've got a lot of new followers on Instagram, which is exciting.
We do. Isn't that fun?
I know. The reels, baby. The reels.
just from three videos.
Yeah, that's what happens when you put your big girl pants on and learn how to like be a little Gen Z social media star, you know.
Just hop on the trends
mm-hmm.
with Pedro Pascal eating a sandwich.
That was good. That was awesome. Pedro Pascal, that man is just, he's everywhere.
He's everywhere. And I love it. I saw one
TikTok the other day that was like, basically like, you know who Pedro Pascal looks like. And then they just show a picture of Bob from Bob's Burgers. And I'm like, yes, it's the daddy energy of it all.
That's funny. I saw a girl on TikTok post about like how like Pedro Pascal went to high school with her mom. Did you see that one?
Mm-mm.
I'll have to go try to find it and send it to you, because it's like they went to high school together and they were friends, like good friends. And he mm-hmm. wrote her like these lovely letters and like signed her yearbook with this awesome note. And when he finished the yearbook signing, he was like, remember my name, or like remember this, or save this, whatever he said.
Uh-huh.
Like just because kind of like manifest him being like this big star actor. But all the other like little notes are just so lovely, and it's like the comments were like, okay, so like Pedro Pascal is definitely in love with your mom, can we get a reunion? Like the notes were just so cute. It was like he got her a wedding card instead of like a graduation card or something like that, because they were like, in the card, he's like, I got you a wedding card because I thought you'd like this better than a graduation card. They're all too cheesy. These ones are nicer. Like,
okay.
And he was just like, you're just such a great friend and I love you so much. Like just stuff like that. And then like all of these other videos that I've seen of Pedro Pascal just being like the epitome of like ADHD. In like a formal setting.
Yes.
I just love it. Like,
do you relate to that, Haley? Do you relate?
I really do. I'm like, okay, this makes me love this guy so much more than just from him acting. It's just like all the wrong things at the wrong time.
Yeah, no, it's like the chaotic energy, the chaotic good energy that like exudes from that human being is it's amazing.
Yeah.
Hopefully he doesn't ever do anything terrible, because you know what I mean, you could like fall in love with these celebrities and then you're like, yeah, but
it was a nice ride.
Yeah.
So that was good while it lasted.
To all our new listeners, this is a survival podcast / tragedy podcast. It is not a Pedro Pascal podcast.
No,
but if you want it to be, we can talk about him a little bit more.
We just are big fans of him.
But we typically do chit chat at the top of the show because like we're friends and this is our catch up time a little bit. So if you want, and you don't want to listen to our bullshit, you can like jump ahead like 15 minutes, but be warned, we are going to go on tangents. It's just how it goes. That mm-hmm. is the vibe for sure.
And Jillian tells the story and then I am like Pedro Pascal energy adjacent. So
yes, sometimes I make you tell the story.
Sometimes I'm not a very good storyteller, so And I also don't like the morbid stories all that much, like you do. So I don't go out and seek them. So that's also there.
You've got a, we've got like a very like golden retriever black cat energy going on.
Guess who's
That's
the black cat?
the vibe. Like that's honestly like been my vibe in every single relationship that I've had. I'm the black cat. Everyone else has been my golden retriever. Like Corey's definitely my golden retriever. My friend Jenny's definitely a golden retriever. Like it's everyone else has golden retriever energy, and then there's me. So
It's all great. It's called balance.
yeah. It is called that's I, you just need the yin and the yang, you know? You need the yin and the yang.
It's
So
true.
I have remember I told you I broke my toe
Oh,
last
yeah.
time? Well, I
Yeah. It's like your third
also
time breaking your toe.
it's my third time. Not the same toe. It's been different toes every time, but
Oh.
yes. And then I also fucked up my sciatic nerve.
Oh no, that sucks.
So
That hurts. Oh, I love your little narwhal tea steeper.
oh, thank you. Oh, and
That's cute.
it's in a narwhal mug.
Oh, I love that.
So
That's really cute.
thank you. I have a manatee as well.
When it's like the manatee, TEAT.
So I've been like literal wreck this week. Oh, and I had to get a crown replaced, or I had to get a crown done
Wow,
on
all
my.
within a week? Well, 2 weeks since I last seen you? Oh my God.
So I had a temporary crown on, and then it was literally like 5 days before I was supposed to get the new one put on, and it just like popped off
Oh
this week. So I had
no.
to go in, do that. I had to put up a new eel ramp, and I had to do a ton of field work this week. So I've been great.
Sounds like you've been great. So, to all the new people, Jillian works in wildlife biology as a fisheries research biologist. And then I used to be in the fisheries field, but then I switched to communication. So now I am the marketing manager of a coral reef lab. So
Yeah. You
that's
definitely
our
do some like
backgrounds.
education adjacent stuff as well too.
Yeah, I do outreach. I work events and stuff, but my background for like the first 7 years of my career was fisheries research. So
This is marine fisheries, so marine
marine fisheries.
biology.
Yeah, marine biology.
Although I definitely dip my toes into freshwater species because a lot of the species I study are anadromous or are able to live in both like saltwater and freshwater habitats. I'm really interested in looking at animals that can make that migration in between the two environments, and because there's just a lot that go on with you know their biology and their life history. And so right now I'm studying American eels and alligator gar, which are both technically freshwater species, but because one of them begins their life stage out in the ocean and the other one regularly goes into saltwater environments. So they're actually one of the top predators down here on the Texas Gulf Coast.
Alligator gar?
Like more
Nice.
so than bull sharks.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, we have a lot of them down here.
Huh.
Yeah, we're like Texas is kind of like a population haven or trying to think of the word right word.
It's
We
like the
just
ideal home for alligator gars.
Yeah, and we don't have a lot of regulations specifically for killing them, so they
Yeah,
tend to
because you can't
thrive.
really eat them, right? Like they're not good to eat.
You can eat them, you just have to get through their armor plate of scales. I mean, these are
Yeah.
prehistoric fish, you know, so they're like dinosaurs. Like tagging them isn't going to be a battle because they only have a few soft spots that you can get through to
Yeah, I was just
insert a
trying to think
tag.
like behaviorally too, like why they are bigger predators than like bull sharks. And I guess it bull sharks can go into freshwater too, but I'm assuming it's they spend most of their time like in saltwater. And like I don't know, I feel like alligator gar, they don't, I don't know. I feel like just behaviorally it's different, which is why they're like more predators, right? That has to be the answer.
Gar can be definitely more like ambush predators.
Yeah, like they just sit and wait.
I think they're pretty generalist, and I wouldn't say though that they reproduce faster necessarily. They might reproduce more babies all at once than a shark would, because sharks typically pup and they have less children, babies than I think just called them children.
That's okay. I mean, we call our coral babies our babies. We're like, oh, look
They
at the
have
cute
less
baby.
offspring, typically, than your average like teleost bony fish, which is what a gar is. But
Yeah.
Gar are pretty long-lived. So they can reproduce multiple times within that lifespan, and they typically produce, you know, more eggs than like a shark would have pups. So I'm wondering if that's potentially why they're so prolific. I think they just really do well in that environment.
Environment. Yeah,
Yeah.
that's interesting.
Not to mention sharks are on the decline worldwide. So
well,
that
yeah,
probably has
there's
something
yeah
to do
for
with it.
a lot of reasons of that too. Which though, like, it's interesting because like worldwide they're on the decline, right? But then like locally here they're bad. Like it, like anglers, like for people that don't know, in the Florida Keys, there are a lot of fishing guides, and that is how they make their living. And when there is a heavy presence of sharks coming in and eating the fish that they're catching, not only is it impacting the fishery, like of the local fish population, but then it's also impacting, you know, the quality of fishing trip that these people are putting on. Because although it's not their fault, the person on the trip will be like, oh my God, a shark ate my fish today. Like, you're not getting a tip, or like bad
I'd
review.
be thrilled, honestly.
Well, and so when I was doing this fishing tournament at the end of December or middle of December of last year, we were in the park, so like Everglades National Park, that area. And as a female on a flats boat, there is no bathroom. You get a bucket, or you lean over the side, or like you go in the water. And as you and I have been in fisheries field for so long, like we're comfortable doing that. Like we're like, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And so, like, I made the joke at the beginning of the trip to the guide. I was like, hey, like, I'm gonna go to the bathroom, but just so you know, like, I'm totally cool, like, peeing off a boat if I need to, just like turn around, or like, give me a bucket, or like, I'll just get in the water.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, you're not gonna wanna get in the water where we're going. And I was like, what? Why? He's like, the sharks are just so bad. Like, they're everywhere. And we got to this one spot, and the water, have you ever seen water that's like, it's like the pale green kind of color, but it's like milky because it's like stirred up so much? I kid you not, everywhere that you looked around the boat, like every second your head turned, there was a shark fin around you.
Oh my
and
God, that's
like
so cool.
We're trying to catch snook and redfish, and I caught a snook and it was great. And then like it was probably one of those fish that would have put us up another spot or two in the ranking, and a freaking shark came and just chomped it. And I was like, oh my God, I totally get why this is so annoying now. Like, I feel that pain.
Yeah.
And so, like, in the fishing community down here, the heavy presence of sharks is, like, a big debate of, like, you know, what
like,
do
how
we
do you
do?
deal with it?
Yeah, how do you deal with it? Like, do we kill them? Like, I mean, because there's fishermen out there that just straight fucking kill them, you know? And then it's, like, because there are fishing regulations on certain shark species down here. So,
Well,
like that's the thing that you can do. But then also it's like I just it's just a big debate topic. Some people think that you shouldn't kill the sharks because of like the worldwide decline. Some people are like, it's hurting my business. So, you know, there's regulations on them. I'm going to that it's lawful to do that. You know, like you can do that. So I'm going to do it. And, you know, it's just it's hard for them out there, which is rough, because then you think about it globally. And it's like, well, they're on the decline. So,
and as a biologist, you're like, no, leave them alone.
I know. It's just, it's a really tough spot to be in for sure. Because locally, like they have a heavy presence down here, and it's impacting people's lives and like their livelihood. But then globally, they're on the decline. So
that's how a lot
like,
of people
what
feel
do you
about
do?
The gar as well, because they're just so prolific down here. But in other states, they basically had you could just go out and slaughter them as many as you wanted, because they were seen as like trash fish and like predators and monsters. And they're actually really, you know, important apex predators. Yeah, it's funny you bring up the whole shark thing too, because when I was doing, I was on a NOAA cruise that I got to volunteer for, but still get paid. That was pretty sweet. So I wasn't really volunteering, but it kind of was. But you're doing long lines where you just leave a bunch of baited hooks out in the middle of the Gulf or the ocean, wherever you're long lining, and then you wait for fish to come by and get caught. So it's like fishing en masse, basically. Hook and line fishing en masse. So we were targeting sharks, and we'd get a lot of smaller ones, and we'd get some big ones, like we caught like a 12-foot female tiger shark, like stuff like that. But a lot of the little sharks would be bitten in half because
Oh,
other sharks would come along and eat them, other
yeah.
larger sharks. And then you just sit there and you're like, oh my God, how many big tiger sharks are out here that we aren't
Yeah.
catching?
Yes. It's amazing, honestly.
So anyway, that's a little intro to who we are and what we do. And it's funny. I'm really excited to be working on a big apex predator because up until now, have been working on very, very small animals. So this is exciting for sure.
Yeah, I'm excited for you.
I just have to like figure out how to get it all done, and that's going to be my headache for the next couple of weeks.
How many people work for you? Like, are you the manager of anybody, or do you just
No.
have, oh, none. Got it.
No, I
Okay.
have to ask for help, basically.
Same boat. That's fun, isn't it?
So I'm a biologist, and I typically have a lot of support from the local techs in the area, which is good, but they have their own stuff that they have to be doing too. So it's a lot of scheduling and like seeing who can do what and when, and it's great. It's a good time.
Do you ever deal with like the dynamic of like them being, I don't know, like kind of in a bad mood because they're like, this isn't really my job. Like it's taking away from other things that I could be doing. Or is it pretty much like they're a tech, so they're supposed to be like dynamic enough to help you? Or
Typically,
like,
yeah, that's the case. But also, I think I get a decent amount of support from them because it's something different. They can
yeah.
get away from their typical like office life or their office, to come try something else and do something else for the day. So typically, I've never had like anybody being mad about having to come help me.
That's
It's
nice.
more just like making sure that there's nothing else that they need to be doing at their offices.
Yeah.
Because I get support from the techs within my own office, but then also another office across town that my
Gotcha.
husband works at. So sometimes Corey and I have science dates.
That's cute. I like that.
But yeah, I mean, typically it's been really great. It's just a lot of work.
Yeah, we're dealing with some growing pains in that kind of department right now. So that's why I was asking, 'cause the you know how I told you that Saturday yesterday was not a good day for me 'cause I had to work. That's what I mean, like the growing pains. It went from like a very casual, "Oh, you should check this out," to, "I need you to work this for me." And it's like, okay, like I also have a life. Like
No, you don't. No, no
no,
life. No life for you.
you're right. Nobody has a life when they work for a nonprofit, right? It's just you wear all the hats and you just do what they say. There's no life.
That is nonprofit life for
Yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now that we've kind of reintroduced ourselves, talk some science stuff. There is definitely a lot of science talk on this podcast. Do we want to get into the story?
Yeah. Oh, is it about dinosaurs? Because I saw the title and I like dinosaurs.
Is not about dinosaurs.
Oh, that
But
sucks.
we are going to be talking about
Okay,
some prehistoric animals,
that's cool.
just like prehistoric mammals.
White Sands National Park. I've always wanted to go there.
I know my dad actually got stationed down there. My dad's retired army colonel, and he was there for like a year when they were training to go overseas to go fight in the desert.
Yeah.
But he had pictures from there. It looks absolutely stunning. Like it looks amazing.
This is in New Mexico. I just see. I'm on the park website right now. I thought I was about to say Utah for a second because I don't know why I was thinking that,
It's
but
like
New
right across
Mexico.
the border from El Paso.
That's where my
So
grandpa was born.
I was thinking about like we did Big Bend this year. So I'm thinking like maybe we do the rest of the national, like so you could have Guadalupe Mountains, Carlsbad, and potentially like White Sands all on the same trip.
Weekend trip. Yeah,
Yeah.
no, that'd be
Not
cool.
weekend. I would take a whole week to do that because
Whoops,
that's
all right.
a long drive. It's like 11
Yeah.
hours to get out to El Paso.
Were you the one that sent me the video of this guy being like, like people in Texas don't vacation outside of Texas because Texas is so big.
Yes.
That was you that sent me that, because I also have a cousin that lives in Dallas, and he's been sending me a lot of videos recently, so I wasn't sure if it was you or him. But yeah, I was like, that's very true, because I've driven through Texas twice, and I've always come through the west side, like around El Paso, and
It's
that
long.
it's yeah, and that part of Texas, you know that scene in Monty Python and the Holy Grail where they're like running up the hill and it just keeps re-going, where it's like
Yes.
it just keeps going back to them running up the hill, and then eventually
Iconic
they get to town.
scene.
Yeah, that's
Iconic.
what was going through my brain when I was driving through West Texas.
Oh
I
my
was like,
God.
am I ever
Yeah.
gonna get out of here? Like, oh my
No.
God.
No. So yeah, so put it all in perspective. I am, let's see, 4 hours from the Louisiana border, 4 hours from the Mexican border, 11 hours from the New Mexico border, probably six, seven from Oklahoma, and maybe six from Arkansas. So that's Texas. Like,
Yeah, it's
we are
far.
not close to any other states really. So
Yeah. I mean, and down here it takes us like just 2.5 hours to get out of the fucking Keys.
Right.
So it's
Florida is
like,
a long state. It's a
it
long
is.
state. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, if you like, I was thinking about trying to go on a camping trip with my boyfriend, but it's one of those things where it's like, oh, like 5 hours seems probably long to somebody that doesn't live on an island, but it's like,
Yeah.
it takes us about 5 hours to get to somewhere that we could go camping or like do like a weekend trip, you know?
Yep, I
So
do know.
yeah.
I very
Yeah.
much know.
Yeah. So you're right in that same boat. It's like, man, we have to like, I don't know. I would like to go camping. Kissimmee National Preserve, I think is what it's called. But it's considered a dark park. So I wanna go
Oh,
there.
cool.
Yeah, I'd like to go there and then try out some astrophotography.
Yeah, Big Bend is also a dark sky park, and it's the first time Corey got to see like the Milky Way, so it was pretty
That's
exciting.
cool. Yeah.
Yeah. My first time was in the Pacific in the middle of nowhere, so
Oh, we'll pin a rose on your nose. Aren't you special?
All right, so let's get into this. So we're still talking about humans because this is about human survival and tragedy in the great outdoors.
Gotcha.
But we're talking about some ancient humans.
Cool,
And
cool.
I have had this idea to do this one in my mind for a while now, just because I'm really fascinated with like prehistoric humans and like what was going on before we wrote shit down, because like our like written history is just a fraction of human history.
Right.
And there's so many stories that have just been lost to time, and it's really interesting when we can find those kind of like snapshots of humans being humans and
Yeah.
living, thinking in many ways the same way we do, even though we have all these like modern devices and everything, ultimately we're still the same.
Yeah.
So
I find the prehistoric time very interesting as well. And like when I was doing that stint out in Utah, there was a lot of petroglyphs around, which I thought was like really cool. Like you could go on hikes and just see like all of these like ancient drawings on the side of these like, what are they? Like the sandstone or whatever red rocks are around there. And then yeah, I just all of this stuff I think is so amazing, because then even in the Grand Canyon there was people that lived in the canyon. And when you go to the Grand Canyon there's like a little museum or something about the canyon people, and it's fascinating to me about how they just lived back then and survived.
I mean, for most of our existence on this planet, our life has been about survival, and so I feel like this is very on point with the kind of things we talk about. So it's going to be a very different episode than what we usually do, but I think it is still going to be pretty cool. And honestly, writing this gave me like the gooseies, like little goosebumps, because just thinking about it like made me kind of have like one of those whoa moments. All right, let's get into it. All right, so we talk a lot about different survival situations on this podcast. We talk about those who climb the tallest mountains, those who climb into the deepest caves, cross the coldest continents, and the widest oceans. We talk about those who are simply in the wrong place at the wrong time and made the best out of a bad situation, which in many ways is the core of the human spirit. But all of these stories, even our oldest stories, have something in common. They were all written down, recorded in one way, shape, or form with words. They were written into the history of human beings. But humans have been around a long time before we began keeping records. In fact, most of human history has gone unrecorded, as recorded history began around 3,000 years ago, maybe a little before that. But human species began appearing almost 3 million years ago.
That's a lot of years ago.
Yeah, that we've just been hanging out, hunting and gathering, you know.
And it's interesting to me, too, that, like, when, like, I don't know. I don't know how to say this the right way. But, you know, like, subconsciously, we still have those, like, Neanderthal abilities, like the whole hunting and gathering and, like,
yeah,
fight or flight responses. Like,
that's why we all have anxiety.
My doctor, well, did I tell you that when I finally got my fucking cortisol tested? And my doctor was like, yeah, so you're pretty much hanging on for dear life with your cortisol levels. And
oh,
I was
good.
Like, oh, okay, cool. And so, like, it's supposed to, like, you know, peak in the morning and then kind of gradually go down. Mine, like, peaks in the morning and then drops off, like, right around 2 p.m. and just stays bottomed out for the rest of the day.
Great.
Which is, like, makes sense because around 2 p.m. I get, like, so exhausted. I, like, need to take a nap or get some caffeine in me. Anyway, so I cannot run. She told me I'm not allowed to run as exercise because when you run, it triggers that innate response where you think you're getting chased like we did back millions of years ago. And then it, like, just your cortisol levels deplete. And I don't have a lot. So I need to start walking and not running. So that's a little personal tidbit.
But it's fascinating because it's like, though that, like, survival instinct is, like, printed onto our DNA at this point. And it's all these things that we don't even realize that we're doing are that, like, echo of all the things that were going on before.
Speaking of DNA, I saw a post, and I don't know how accurate this is because it was on Instagram, but the animals that are around Chernobyl, apparently they are, their DNA is evolutionarily adapting at, like, such a faster rate than the rest of the animals that's, like, 10 miles away from that, or, like, greater than 10 miles away from that site.
Yeah. There's definitely something different going on with the animals around Chernobyl. And part of it is because they have, like, the environment to expand into because there's no more humans. So, like, they're able to, you know, really thrive. But yeah, also, you know, nuclear stuff does weird things to DNA. So I'm not surprised. I'm curious. I'll go look into that and see if that is indeed correct. Cause that's crazy. Crazy fast.
Yeah, we all know that I get my information from Instagram these days. So I say things before I fact check them. Just fair warning for everybody else. And probably next episode I'll be like, oh yeah, I looked into this and it's not correct. So
yeah. All right. Back to caveman. Caveman
tangent
times.
One. Already on.
So our ancestors have always found ways to leave notes behind, whether it was, like, deliberate in, like, cave paintings, carvings, like petroglyphs, like you were talking about, art, or if it was unintentional with the artifacts left in their wake, the carvings left on bones of the animals that they consumed, or things like footprints, or even fossilized shit. That's a thing.
That's true. Yeah, that is a thing. Poop has been fossilized, and there's been, like, research done from that to see what the animals have eaten. Like woolly mammoths, right? Didn't they look at woolly mammoth poop to see, like, what was in their digestive system or something?
Hold on. I got to remember. Coprolite. That's fossilized poop. Coprolite.
Oh.
That's the official
Why do
name.
They got to give a fancy name to it?
It's science, baby. We got to.
Just, like, hard shit. That's all it is.
It's hard shit. That's all it is. Title of the episode. So, and until they formed societies and began farming, humans have done what they've always done for millions of years, and that is survive. And as we, as us humans living in the modern age, are the results of that millions of years of survival, which is weird to think about. So today we take a look at two very small but important snapshots in time, two lives of two women and the clues that they left behind. Today we talk about prehistoric human survival.
Cool.
So
female empowerment too.
Yeah. female empowerment. They just happen to both be
they just
female.
Happen to be female.
Yeah. And one of them's speculative anyway, but it is still very interesting.
Wait, why?
We'll get into it. We'll get into it. So one of my favorite stories of prehistory and paleontology is the story of how humans and other animals migrated to the Americas during the last ice age. The history of how the ancestors of Native Americans reached the Americas is long and convoluted, and much is still up to question as new evidence is constantly brought to light. One of the original theories introduced around 1908 in New Mexico was based on 10,000-year-old spear points found in bison fossils and later in spear points found in Clovis, New Mexico, around 13,000 years ago. And this was thought to indicate that this is when humans began migrating across the Bering Land Bridge from Siberia into the Americas, following large game like mammoths. And these were called the Clovis people. And for those of you who don't know, who didn't, I don't know, go through the American education system, the Bering Land Bridge, during the last ice age, sea levels were much lower than they are now. And so there was a land bridge that connected basically Russian Siberia and Asia to Alaska in the Americas. And so that's the migration route for a long time. That was the only route it was thought that people took to get to the Americas, just to put it in the most basic terms. So for a long time, the Clovis peoples were considered the first Americans, until other evidence was found in the 1990s. In 1997, evidence was found in Chile that human occupation was dated to 14,000 years ago, which was 1,000 years earlier and much farther away from the Bering Land Bridge than the Clovis peoples had been, because Chile is all the way at the bottom of that big mega continent. You know, it's at the bottom of South America. And the Bering Land Bridge is at the very tippy top. So why were there people all the way down there 1,000 years earlier, right?
That's so a great question. I'd love to find out.
Yes. So more sites were discovered, including a site in 2011 located in Hill Country in central Texas called Buttermilk Creek. And that was dating as early as 15,500 years ago. And there were 16,000 artifacts in the area. Which was kind of an indicator that these people weren't like migrating actively. They were just like hanging around. This was their home. So they were established in the area. Michael Waters of Texas A&M, who is the principal investigator at the Buttermilk Creek site, stated, "I think the data clearly show that people were in America at least 16,000 years ago. Time will tell if that represents the initial occupation of the Americas or if there was something even earlier."
Yeah.
So how did the first Americans arrive, if not for Beringia? It's thought that many ancestral Americans arrived on something called the Kelp Highway.
The Kelp Highway?
Yes. Which is a It's cool. It's so cool, though. Okay. So it's this continuous ecosystem of kelp, like kelp forests. Like
yeah, my brain just went right to SpongeBob, honestly. That's why I started laughing.
So they think this ecosystem stretched from Asia through Beringia down the west coast of the Americas. And it was so like prosperous with like fish and marine mammals that it could sustain migrants for like long distances. So they would just go down on boats following the coast instead of walking across the continent.
That's really interesting. And I'm curious, like, if over time that kelp forest that's on the coast of California is just what's left because of just habitat decline.
Yeah, and how climate changes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that stretches all the way up through, like, southern Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about it, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I never knew that. And now my brain's spinning. I'm going to have to look that up later.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't know either. Like, cause we were all taught that everyone came over on the Bering Land Bridge when we were in school.
Yeah.
And like doing this research of like, oh no, there's like a whole nother side to this, which is cool. So let's talk about some more evidence. So there's evidence of this kelp highway theory from a 13,000 year old man, on the Channel Islands in California. They found his body and some artifacts from his people to kind of support this. Furthermore, maritime peoples of Japan were using boats as early as 25,000 to 30,000 years ago. So we know these people could undergo at least coastal travel via boat at that time. Lastly, genetic analysis of many of these skeletons indicate that the ancestors of Native Americans were Asians separated from other Asian groups for at least 10,000 years. These genetic signatures are those that only Native Americans possess. So we know kind of where they, at least how far back they were separated genetically from those people, that they stopped like interbreeding with those people.
Okay, now I'm getting a little confused. So like I'm sure you can see it on my face too. So we know that these people came over from like the Asian continents because like of the connection there with the land bridge and stuff. And so are you saying like the like Neanderthal, like Native American way back long ago, like they're showing Asian traits, so that therefore that kind of like solidifies that they came from that area? Okay.
They, if you go far about enough back in like the genetic similarities between like Asian Siberian peoples and Native American peoples, you can see that they're connected. But all indigenous peoples in the Americas, in the continental Americas, have been separated from those groups for at least 2,000 years, and we can tell that by genetics, basically,
Gotcha.
because they
Okay,
have
cool.
significant genetic traits. Neanderthal, side note, Neanderthals are actually European, and they're
Oh.
a different species than Homo sapiens.
See, this is why I'm not in the sciences anymore.
And fun fact, if you're Caucasian, if you have a European ancestry, you have about 4% Neanderthal, 2 to 4% Neanderthal DNA, especially if you're from Northern Europe.
I definitely have that on my 23andMe. I'll say this
You
later.
do? You have a little
Yeah, I'm pulling it
Neanderthal?
up. I'm pulling it up right now.
Oh, so you're not fully
Woo,
human. Woo!
I'm weird. Woo.
I mean, I probably have Neanderthal DNA too, because I'm like Russian and English and Norwegian, so.
So I just got my 23andMe results up, and there's not a single Neanderthal word on here. So it's just trace ancestry is 0.5% and unassigned is 0.1%.
So
So
that could be like anything.
that's probably what I was thinking of. I swear I saw it at one point though.
Yeah, but it's definitely a thing. Like, if you come from Northern Europe, there's a decent chance that you have Neanderthal DNA because Neanderthals and humans had did the deed together.
Yeah, I'm
They
like
had good
I
times.
it's the 99.4% European, and then it breaks it down into like what parts of Europe.
So anyway, that's a side note. Yeah, Neanderthals are actually, they never made it to the Americas, just humans did.
Gotcha.
All right,
Interesting.
so.
And now I learned something new and just have reconfirmed why I'm not in sciences anymore. Every day when I'm around a scientist, I'm like, yeah, this is why I'm not smart enough. Not smart enough. That's why I don't do
Don't
it.
feel like I'm smart enough either, but I'm curious, so I think that
Yeah.
makes up for it a little bit because I'm kind of dumb too.
Like I can do the work. That's why I was a tech, but if you want me to write a paper, probably not the best idea.
I mean, everybody has their own, path, and it doesn't necessarily, you don't have to be a scientist to work in the sciences. That's the cool
No.
thing about them. So we need everybody. We need all types to help out and disseminate information to other people, and it's important. It's important. Okay, what was I talking about?
Neanderthals. Asian travelers, Native Americans.
So another bit of evidence for like supporting the Kelp Highway is they found the coprolites, the fossilized poop in caves, like on the Oregon and like Washington coast that like date back like 15,000 years or something like
Oh,
that.
wow.
So there's like evidence that humans were there, but they found it in their fossilized poop.
That's crazy.
And all this is like carbon dated, by the way.
Yeah.
All right, so in addition, many of these people, eight groups of ancient peoples, appeared to be settled in and exploiting their environment instead of just passing through it, meaning that they had made the continent their home and they were no longer migrating. The research and others have lended to the idea that there were not just one like big migration of humans to the Americas, but there were likely multiple waves of migrations, either by land or by sea, and that humans may ha have been in the Americas 20,000 years ago or older. And so that's just so fascinating to me that, like,
That makes sense to me. And that's what I always thought was like it just came in like waves of people. Like I never thought there was one big rush to a new land.
And at some point, though, they were separated. The, Bering Sea kind of filled it back in, and at that point, I think is where you start seeing those like genetic markers start to come from because they were just isolated for so long. Not to mention, like somebody who's down in Chile isn't going to go all the way back up to go mate with somebody from Siberia. So there was only limited genetic mixing in that way anyway,
Yeah.
too. So it's just
Super
really, I
interesting.
thought it was cool. So I wanted to
Yeah.
talk about it.
Yeah, no, that is really interesting. It's like, how did we get here? Why are we here?
Yeah.
Like, who are we
Yeah.
just from thousands of years ago? And
Well,
like 20,000 years ago, that's not really that long ago. I mean, like, big scale.
Yeah, I know, because Earth's been around for like what, 4.6 billion years or
Yeah.
something
And
like
like,
that. Yeah.
the Americas are like the youngest continent, right?
Well,
Not continent, but like excuse me, like you could go to Europe and there's things that are older than like historic things in the Americas. Like,
oh,
you know what I mean? I
yeah,
don't know how to say
for
that.
human habitation,
Yeah, human habitation. Yeah, see again, not smart, don't know how to This is
well,
why
and
Jolene is here.
my family's only been here since like the 1700s, so I'm not actually right. I
Yeah.
might, there's been talk that we have some Native American ancestry, but I don't really know how true that is anymore.
I know, I think if I'm not remembering this story right, I know I'm not, but my grandma's mom, I believe, came over from Croatia. So like that, like generation wise, that's like what, two, three generations prior? Not very long ago.
Yeah, I had like my mom's family came over during the Russian Revolution, so
Yeah.
same. My dad's side, though, we have ancestry tied to the Mayflower, so they've been
Cool.
here long for white people. We were
Yeah.
the OG colonizers, but ultimately we're talking about the ancestors of the indigenous peoples in North
Yeah.
America, or yeah, in South America. So let's get into some of these people. So our first story tells the story of a single human being, a human who was one of the first Americans, and is some of the oldest human remains ever to be found in the Western Hemisphere. This story tells the tale of a brief life with a tragic end, but the data scientists were able to collect from this person changed the way we see the linealogy of all indigenous peoples in the Americas. Data that clearly connects indigenous peoples to these ancient migrators. So let's get into the story of Naya. In 2007, a team of Mexican divers led by Alberto Nava found a submerged cavern in a cenote called Hoyo Negro, or Black Hole. At the bottom of this cave, there was a bed of prehistoric bones, including a complete human skeleton. After Nava reported the skeleton to the National Institute of Anthropology and History in Mexico, a team of international archaeologists and researchers were brought together to start investigating the cave and the bones that called the cave their final resting place in 2014 and 2016. It turned out that the skeleton was the remains of one of the oldest Americans, and her bones tell the story of a hard but brief life.
So let's just recap what a cenote is, real quick. That's a cave filled with water. So, cave diving. And if you're new here, I hate caves. And so, I was just chuckling a little bit when you said that, a team of cave divers found bones. I was like, this is why we don't go cave diving. Like,
The possibility to find bones is too real.
yes. Or just a dead person. Like, I just. No, thank you. I do not
We
want to do that.
recently we did a cave diving episode like two or three episodes ago, so
Yes, where they found a dead person. So
Well, here's a we'll bring cave diving to like a new light here, because nobody actually dies in the
They're
modern times
just
during
already
this.
dead.
Yeah, just there's already dead people. So the Hoya Negro is a cenote or a water-filled sinkhole, resulting from the collapse of limestone bedrock that exposes the groundwater underneath. Many cenotes, including the Hoya Negro, are the collapsed roof of an expansive cave system that forms like a kind of pond right into the cave. And these caves are filled with fresh water at the surface and intruding salt water from the sea beneath, especially in the region that we're talking about, which is the Yucatan Peninsula.
Gotcha.
Mayans commonly use cenotes as they were the only source of fresh water on the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico. At the end of the last glacial maximum, rising sea levels flooded the maze of cave passages and in turn has preserved many of the bones found here. Cenotes in the Yucatan Peninsula are veritable gold mines for Mayan archaeology and even older Paleo-American archaeology, which I've always found them very fascinating.
Yeah.
So the human skeleton was dubbed Nyx, after the water nymphs in Greek mythology, and was one of the oldest complete skeletons found in the Americas at 12,000 years old to 13,000 years old. According to archaeologists, she fell to her death, likely while exploring the cave. She contained enough bone material for genetic extraction as well as facial reconstruction, which I love facial reconstruction. It's so
Yeah.
interesting. So cool. I don't know how it works, but it's so cool to me. It's so neat. And we'll put her facial reconstruction on Instagram for sure. From her skeleton, researchers have recovered 98 bone elements and 30 teeth, including a complete skull, all complete bones of the arm and left leg, most ribs and vertebrae, and almost complete pelvis and almost complete hands. Researchers have also created a facial reconstruction showing what she looked like. Analysis of her bones told a brief but violent tale of her life, indicating two major traumatic events written in her bones.
Oh.
This one's a little rough.
Well, it's amazing how we can just find that from a skeleton.
Forensics, baby.
I know the
It's
technology we have now.
I know. I love it. It's thought that Naya traveled long distances on foot, but didn't carry much on her journeys and instead like foraged for food as she moved along. This lifestyle was indicated by the fact that her upper body did not have evidence of heavy muscling, but her lower legs did, showing that she roamed widely over the landscape and did not skip leg day.
Woohoo! Can't skip leg day.
James Chatter is an American archaeologist working on the project with Mexico's National Institute of Anthropology and History, says of the bones, she's telling us a story. It was a very hard life. Data suggests that she was about 15 to 16 years old and stood about 5 feet tall.
Oh, she's a tiny one.
Yeah. Her weight potential was 110 pounds.
Oh,
But due
golly.
to malnutrition evidenced by the bones, it's likely she was much lighter than that.
Gotcha.
Evidence of malnutrition was seen in her shin bones, which show evidence of halting growth. Chatters describes her as rail skinny, as one of her upper arm bones was only as thick as his little finger. It's possible that foraging for resources was difficult and resources became more scarce in this region over time. Both bones of her left forearm show healed fractures, indicating that she had broken her arm. This trauma is thought to have been caused by another human.
Oh.
As the bone would have been broken with a twisting and pulling method instead of like if you hit it on a rock, means
Oh,
that somebody
gross.
grabbed her and broke it.
Yeah, like she got in a fight or like was trying to get away from somebody.
So
Ooh, I
yeah,
just
there's
got chills.
lots of it.
My
I know. The goosies.
hair on my
The
arm is standing up.
goosies. It's 'cause it's like this stuff still happens today. It
Yeah.
could be an abusive partner or an abusive family member. It doesn't necessarily have to be a stranger.
Yeah.
you know? And there's evidence of it healing. So did somebody break her arm and then be like, oh shit, let me heal it for you, you know? I mean, there's lots of speculation as to like who did this to her, but I mean, these are things that we are trying to figure out with bodies of murder victims, you know? So that just shows that like forensics has a lot of application beyond like true, like, you know, crime and stuff like that.
Yeah, at
Apply it
work they're
to.
actually using forensics for like dolphins.
Yeah. I don't know.
I was
Why are
like,
they using forensics for dolphins?
I didn't read the article all the way through. You know how I told you I see things and I'm like, oh, that's cool, but then I like don't read into it more.
Too long, didn't
Again, ADD can't handle that.
yeah, there's so many applications, and this is just one of them. There's also evidence that Naya had given birth at least once in her lifetime. And remember, she's
She's like
15,
17, 15
16.
when she died.
Yeah, 15 or 16, they said.
Oh, so pretty much hit puberty, had a kid, and then got the hell out of there.
And this is due to sacral damage on her pelvis, which
Ooh.
sacral damage can come from a child's head being forced through a birth canal of a pelvis that is too small to accommodate it. So
Yeah,
that
'cause
means
she's like 15.
she was probably really young, like maybe
Yeah.
11 or 12.
Ew.
That
Gross.
unfortunately is how a lot of that has happened historically.
Yeah, and also I guess they didn't really live as long. So
No.
when
No,
you
they
like think
didn't.
about timeline of life events, that's probably on par of what they would have
Yeah.
expected.
And again, these are things that are still happening today, unfortunately. If we want to get on the abortion talk again, we can, but
We don't need to do that. If you want to hear that, you can go to the last episode.
yeah, we went on a long tangent.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's just so fascinating to see that we can still tell these things, and like these are things that are still happening to women today.
Yeah.
Like things have not changed all that much. I mean, they have,
No.
but like they haven't. So her pelvis also shows evidence of a break, although this did not heal. So this means that this was the indirect or direct cause of her death.
Oh, so like that's what broke when she fell.
Yeah. So it's thought that she fell more than 100 feet into the Hoyo Negro, which may have been dry or nearly dry at the time she entered the cave. So she wouldn't have hit water. If she did hit water, it was very shallow.
Oh God, that poor woman.
She may have been exploring the cave passage to see if it could be used as a shelter for resources at the time, because oftentimes there's like salt deposits in caves. Maybe she was hiding, you know, from somebody or something. Because there were
Yeah.
lots of different predatory and herbivorous, like there were mammoth bones, or sorry, not mammoth, mastodon bones, and like sloths, and I think there was a saber-toothed tiger, and like that kind of stuff also found at the bottom.
Gotcha.
So, if there was a shallow pool at the basin, it's likely a fall would have caused her to drown due to unconsciousness or because she was debilitated. So it's possible that she didn't die immediately from the break, but drowned instead,
Gotcha.
which either way,
It's
wow.
horrible either way. Yeah.
Yeah. So Naya, though, continues to provide important information on what life may have been like for Paleo Americans, as well as serving as a link between the Siberian Beringian ancestors and the modern Native Americans. There has been much debate as to why the Asian ancestors of the Americas look so different from modern day Native Americans. And for a while, it was thought that Native Americans were not the quote unquote first Americans, and that they were derived from another group of migrants instead of these 12,000 plus year old Asian ancestors. Naya shares both the Asian morphology, which means like the Asian look based on the facial reconstruction, but she has the DNA shared by the Native American ancestors, or by
Oh.
Native American indigenous
Okay.
peoples. Yeah. So this indicates that the differences in morphology was likely driven by evolutionary changes upon living in the North American continent. Rather than like actual genetic differences. So they just started to look different over time, which happens with a lot of different species and stuff like that.
That's interesting.
So Which I think makes sense because we don't look like Neanderthals. We don't look like early humans.
No.
You know what I mean? So I don't know why that was such a big, I feel like there's probably racism involved, but that's just my sinking feeling.
Guaranteed racism is involved.
But this, the fighting of Nyaya and others like her is kind of like the proof, like, that Native Americans absolutely are the first and only Americans, i.e. the descendants of Nyaya and the others that came over from like Siberia and Beringia.
So since she had like Native American and Asian DNA in her, that means that she wasn't like the first one of her family to come over. It was like she was like generational. Okay. Similar to how you and I are generational from our grandparents coming over like hundreds of years ago. Okay, gotcha.
So Naya lived a brief and violent life. She experienced trauma as a young child, struggled to make her way in a terrifying and sparse world, and may have actually brought new life into the world and passed on her genes to those who still live in the Americas today. In many ways, her life could have been considered insignificant. She died very young, likely alone in the bottom of a deep, dark cave, and
That's
remained
so sad.
undiscovered for over 10,000 years. She could have gone forgotten. But her story resurfaced, and she is now considered an ancestor representing the lineage of every modern Indigenous American and has become more important than she could ever understand or imagine.
I just got the chills again.
I know.
I mean, that's really cool stuff. Imagine like finding out that this person is an ancestor of yours. And then you like this story is just it, I don't know, it's really cool to me because it's like she lived this short life, but in such a short life she had such an impact, and then even in her afterlife she's teaching us things,
It's
so I
so
think that's really
I'm
cool.
getting the back of my neck is literally like I can feel it. It's so funny.
Yeah.
It's so and like the fact that we have that information and are able to like get that information is
Yeah.
so it's just so cool. I love it, and that's why I wanted to do this story because we are all the product of that survival.
Yeah.
You know, because our ancestors in Europe were doing the same thing. I there are some stories that I'd love to do about like the European, Asian, African side of this, but I these two stories like really called out to me. I found this one in a National Geographic article like years ago, and it just like has stuck with me for so long.
Isn't there something like similar about people with blue eyes can all be related back to the one person?
Who had a
Yeah.
genetic mutation? So we're
So technically,
all
like you and I are like related back to that person.
We are.
Hey, sister.
What's up? I mean, technically every human on this planet is related if you go back far enough. So, that's why I just really don't understand racism. But, anyway, our next story is an even shorter snapshot in time. And this one is so cool. This is the one that triggered me to want to make this story. Or to do this topic. It represents a period of time, an hour, maybe two, in two young humans' lives.
An hour of time? Are they itty bitty, or are they just like this was an hour of their time and they died?
Just an hour or two of their time in their lives.
Wow.
But in this moment, we see something so surreal. We see ourselves. We see human behavior, behavior that we can understand and imagine ourselves doing were we in the same situation. We see the same social ties that drive our lives, social ties that have endured across generations, through centuries, and across millennia. And most importantly, we see that even now, humans have been relying on each other to survive, even since the dawning of our timeline as a species. So now we're going to the White Sands Missile Range,
Cool.
slash
I'm buckled
National
up.
Park.
I'm ready for the ride.
So Lake Otero, which is in White Sands, contains the largest collection of fossilized human footprints in the world. During the last ice age, which was around 10,000 years ago, Lake Otero sat in the Tularosa Basin, and the ecosystem surrounding it was grassland, prairies, wetlands, that kind of ecosystem. It is now an absolute dunescape of a desert.
I was going to say, wow, have times have changed.
Yes. The area was home to a large herbivores, including ancient camels, Colombian mammoths, and Harlan's ground sloth, which was
the
like,
gigantic sloths.
Yes.
Cool.
Yes.
I like those.
And they also, among those grazing, had the dire wolf and American lion hunting them. All of these animals left footprints in the wetlands as well.
Wait, the dire wolf was actually a real thing?
Yes.
Oh, I thought that was just for like Game of Thrones.
No, it's a real prehistoric giant wolf, basically.
Oh, that's neat. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Inside the human footprints that were found as well, researchers found ancient grass seeds that were analyzed via radiocarbon dating. So they were able to show when those footprints happened, like pinpoint kind of the time period, because there was grass seed pressed into them.
Wow.
I know.
That's interesting.
The radiocarbon dating showed that humans had been living in the Tularosa Basin for 23,000 years, which is much older than it was thought humans were ever living in North America originally. So this is even older than like Nia.
Oh.
Yeah, 23,000 years.
Okay, now I see why you flip-flopped the stories, because
yeah.
we went like earliest and then far. I see what you did.
Timeline, baby. Timeline. Mm-hmm. Gotta keep the continuity. So this was a startling discovery. However, more surprising and humanizing discovery was about to be made here. Scientists would find a moment frozen in time. So ancient footprints have been found at the White Sands National Park for 60 years, but examining the tracks has become a big priority in recent years as erosion of the sites have become like more apparent.
Mm-hmm.
In 2006, a group of scientists found dark spots dotting the expanse of the lake bed that turned out to be direwolf, ground sloth, and human footprints buried under a layer of sediment.
I was going to say, that just says a story right there. A direwolf, a sloth, and a human footprint.
Right. They're all living together, doing the things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of like when you go to like a marsh in the morning and you'll see like heron footprints and like raccoon footprints and everybody who was there like the night before.
Yeah.
But like on a bigger, more geological like standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
So based on the radiocarbon dating seed evidence, these specific ones were dated to 18,000 years ago. In 2018, researchers discovered a specific set of footprints that are thought to belong to a woman walking for almost a mile with toddler footprints showing up beside her throughout the trip.
Oh, so she carried her baby and then also walked a little bit and then carried it and walked a little bit.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The evidence showed that she carried the child, shifting them from side to side, as occasionally setting the child down for some time. This was evidenced by the footprints broadening and slipping into the mud due to the additional weight of the child at various intervals. The child was estimated to be under the age of 2 by the size of its feet.
Oh, baby.
Right. And it's like such a small snapshot and just so incredibly human.
Yeah.
You know?
It's amazing like what you can tell and like what story you can form from just footprints.
I know. I know.
Like that, even like in wildlife tracking, it's like, you know, like what you were saying, like you can tell if they've slipped or like how far deep in the mud their footprint is, and like how heavy they were, or like, I don't know, the distance between the feet, or like the stride, like it, and
forensics. Well, it's like, you know, we were talking about a while ago, we did the Dyatlov Pass incident, and talking about how they knew they were barefoot because of like the way that they were running and like the weight of the foot and all that. And it's like, oh, so cool. So fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more evidence to the story though, to kind of fill in some of the stuff. So based on the other footprints around, at least 2 large animal tracks crossed the paths of the woman and the child at the time that they were walking, or in the same like day or so they were walking.
Oh, so like you see like the footprints of the humans and then you see like an animal footprint, like either like parallel to them or like across, like going, cutting across them.
Yeah.
That makes me think of like my zoo days where we would do like the interpretation of like the immersive exhibits, and it's like,
Yeah.
don't touch the animals. If you see an animal crossing your path, give them space. Let them, you know, like,
Except
don't
this,
touch
except
them.
they're
Let them
like,
pass.
you know, like saber-tooth tigers and
Yeah,
shit.
and
Like,
like you just stand, keep your distance.
yeah.
Have you seen? Oh, this is gonna be a little tangent, so you can cut this out if you want. But have you seen Nature Walk with Lenny Pepperbottom?
Of course I have.
How he's like, I think you're really neat, but I respect your distance.
Hey, that's pretty neat.
Yeah, you can tell it's an aspen by the way that
You can tell that it is it by the way that it is.
it is. Yeah.
You gotta pack a gun. You gotta
Yeah.
bring the heat.
Bring the just shake the earth up a little bit.
If you haven't watched those, I feel like they're very much like a relic of like millennial YouTube, but Nature Walks with it's Lenny Pepperbottom, right?
Yes.
Iconic,
Yes, very iconic.
iconic.
So when like we would do the, you know, if you see an animal crossing your path, like give them distance, let them cross.
Yeah.
That always played in my head where it was like, I think you're pretty neat, but I respect your distance.
But I respect your distance. So the animals, though, that were crossing this child and woman's path, they were prints left by a sloth, a
The big
giant
sloth.
ground sloth, which are like basically the size of grizzly bears or larger.
Oh God. Did they
Like
move
they're.
as slow as sloths do today, or did they move faster
I
or slower?
think they move faster than like tree sloths, just based on they kind of fill the role of like an elephant would, where
Okay.
they're like foraging trees and like knocking them down to get the
I
tops of
see.
the trees,
Yeah.
and that's kind of like their role. So they are about 3 meters tall, which is
Okay.
like 9 feet. So yeah,
Gotcha.
they're about the size of like a grizzly or polar bear, something like that.
Okay.
So they're big and they have really big toenails,
Yeah.
claws that they use for like foraging plants, but you
Could definitely
could
kill you.
use them as defense, and I'm sure they probably did.
Yeah.
So the prints left by the sloth suggests that that animal was aware of the humans who had passed the same way before it. Because when it reaches their set of prints, it rears up on its hind legs, possibly to sniff the air for like danger before moving forward, so it could smell them.
Oh, so you see like four sloth prints, and
Yeah.
then like at a point in time, you see just like the back two
Yeah.
prints, and
Yeah.
then okay, interesting.
Which, so they would
Interesting.
have been in the area potentially right around that time.
Yeah, like a couple miles away, kind
Yeah.
of thing.
So a mammoth also walked across the tracks, but showed no evidence of noticing the human presence. But all of these animals were in the same area at the same time. The footprints of the humans hurry on for almost a mile, and it's thought that the woman may have delivered the child to a safe destination before like returning and doubling back. Based on evidence, they were carrying the child at about 3.8 miles per hour in the mud, which is pretty fast.
Yeah, they're definitely going away from something, right?
Look at it. Yeah.
Yeah.
The ground was wet and slick, and the mud that they were walking in at speed, which would have been exhausting, said Bennett and Reynolds, which are some of the authors of the Science Direct paper or article published in 2020 on this specific event. Then it theorizes further. Was the child sick, or was it being returned to its mother? Did a rainstorm quickly come in, catching a mother and child off guard? We have no way of knowing, and it's easy to give way to speculation for which we have little evidence. So it's possible that this might have been an older sister carrying a younger brother. It may not have been
Yeah.
a mother and child,
Yeah.
but the relationship is there. You know, this child was important to this person to some degree. Many of the other footprints discovered in this area were thought to have been mostly from teenagers and children, which may have been tasked with fetching and carrying the kids while adults were involved in more skilled tasks such as hunting. foraging. These footprints have been found coexisting and interacting with extinct Ice Age animals. Some have been found to be a single human stalking and hunting a giant ground sloth, although there's no evidence showing that they managed to kill it, just that they were following it. Other tracks show children potentially playing in puddles formed by the tracks of other large animals, such as mammoths.
Which, oh, like there's a big old footprint there, and then there's like teeny footprints in the middle of the big footprint.
Yeah.
That's
which,
cute.
I love that. Marie Salter, the superintendent of White Sands National Park, stated, "I am so pleased to highlight this wonderful story that crosses millennia. Seeing a child's footprints thousands of years old reminds us why taking care of these special places is so important."
Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, did they preserve those footprints and put them in like the nature center at the national park or
I
something?
don't know, actually. That would be, I'm sure they have ways of like preserving those footprints, like with like plaster maybe.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, that'd be cool if they kept them out there in the park and, like, just kind of, like, fenced them off. But also knowing people and how they don't respect those types of rules, I would have, like, rather did some sort of cast or, like, removed the ground and preserved it, put it in some sort of, like, nature center or something.
Yeah. I think there's just so many footprints that they're just kind of left out there. But I'm sure they did their due diligence in recording the... I don't know how it works. I'm not in the forensic... like archaeology kind of field, so I have no idea, but I can look and see if they have like preserved them, like a cast I would think you'd be able to do maybe.
Or if you and Corey ever go out there, just bring the idea to them.
Okay. I'm sure you've never thought of this before, but so these stories reach back at us from the beginning of our species, and although these people lived vastly different lives than we do, we can still see the familiarity that ties us to them. We see a young woman giving birth, maybe scared, too young, with no way out of her predicament, which I live in Texas, so we see children playing in the landscape around them. We see a caretaker and a child making a journey through a danger-filled world, which if you just think of the thousands of refugees coming out of war-torn countries or like Mexico or the Middle East, that's the same. It's the same. We see us. These traits and stories are written across our own tales of survival and are similar to every story of tragedy and survival in nature that we've talked about so far on this podcast. It links us back to our own origins in the natural world and shows us that humans continue to do what they've always done in the face of the monstrous, beautiful, and awesome world around them, and that is survive.
It's all a survival story at the end of the day.
It is. And that is the our prehistoric survival episode. Prehistoric survival number one. Maybe there'll be more.
Yeah, I like that. Those were good stories.
I know, they're like, they make you feel things, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I think people forget that, like, there was life on this earth, like, thousands of years ago. Like, there were people that were impacted by, like, Mother Nature, you know? And animals coexisted with us, like, it was all a thing. I just can't imagine, like, living back in a time where giant sloths are walking across your trail.
Yeah. And it's interesting because you think about it, Africa is the only continent that still has these megafauna. It's the only place you can go to experience something like this. But we used to have it all here.
Yeah.
We used to have all that megafauna.
Like, just imagine, because, like, where I live is on, it's refuge land for the most part. Like, so in front and behind me, the county owns that land. It'll never be developed.
Yeah.
So, like, just imagine if giant sloths were still a thing and they were just like, you just see like the pines just kind of swaying because you're like, oh, there's an animal that's feeding over there. That would freak the shit out of me. Like,
I know.
That would scare me. I'm like, why are the trees moving that way?
They just come and like try to get on your deck and just like falls apart because they're just.
Like, it reminds me of like how kangaroos are technically like pests in Australia, but to me, kangaroos seem so cool.
I know. There's
they're
just
really
so
not that
many of them.
cool.
They're like white-tailed deer, you
Yeah.
know? And I feel like white-tailed deer in some cases, I mean, we hunt them obviously, but also like if they get too populous, they can have like issues with overpopulation and disease. And yeah, so like we killed all the major like apex predators that used to hunt them, like the wolves and the grizzly bears used to be in like eastern North America, and now they're only in the West in small isolated populations. But that's part of the reason why deer are so bad. I don't know if that's why kangaroos are so, well, it might be because they killed off a lot of the predators, like the Tasmanian wolf or
Devil.
Tasmanian tiger.
Tiger.
That's like an extinct predatory species, like marsupial.
Yeah.
And you can see pictures of the last one that was in a zoo in like the early 1900s.
Well, and like rhinos, wasn't the white rhino? Like it just got extinct like a couple of years ago because the last one in captivity died. It's really sad when you see extinction in your lifetime.
I know.
And I
I
don't
know.
think it was ever comprehended of how important those extinction events were like hundreds of years ago. And now I don't know. To me, I've said it before to you. It's like imagine the stuff like conservation wise that will happen in our lifetime, and we'll be able to look back on it and be like, I remember when like you could do X, Y, and Z kind of thing. Like eating sea turtles, that's frowned upon now and illegal. But like in the 1960s, that was still happening down here. That's not that long ago.
No, it's not.
It's impressive to me, just the type of species that existed before us, and then us in our current lifetime seeing extinction and having like near extinction issues, like coral reef. That is like we consider the Florida's coral reef tract to be functionally extinct. It cannot survive on its own without human interaction. And like if nobody does anything, we will see a whole ecosystem go extinct in our lifetime. From like the 1970s when it was flourishing to 2023 where it's nearly dead. Like what the fuck is up? So then when we're like 80 years old, we'll be able to look back and be like, holy crap, we've had all of these major environmental like happenings in our lifetime. Traumatizing, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like if you go into this field, you have to expect a certain level of depression.
Yeah, straight up.
I would love to be a man in like the 1940s and 50s and just be able to go around the world and like discover animals instead of like trying to figure out how to preserve what we have still. Like
Yeah.
I like the like naive side of me would like love to just be able to do that, you know, instead of doing what I'm doing now, which is, you know, try to make sure we're maintaining populations. And I just want to see cool animals, man. That's all I want to
I know. I just want to see cool animals. I agree with you. It's all I
do.
want to do too.
I want to be like a Jane Goodall, you know,
Yeah.
except not with chimpanzees because they're terrifying. Hi,
Hi, Marzi. A baby.
oh, daddy's playing with the baby. That's my
Hi,
dog
Corey.
and my husband.
Hi,
I
Corey.
see you. Come here.
He's like on all fours at the door. Hey.
Oh, there you are. Yeah. Get him. Where's he? Get him.
Oh, she like does the whole run around in a circle thing.
She'll find Haley.
That's
Yeah,
cute.
and we're still recording, actually. So if you could get her downstairs.
That would be great. I really don't care about all that. That's funny. Alex.
I keep her stuff in there all the time.
Yeah.
Her little
Alex
like.
does that with Waylon, and he is just funny. The two of them together, it's just funny. But Piper's over today, so
Oh
they have
yes.
each other right now.
So speaking of extinction, do y'all have a conservation corner?
I do. I'm gonna read it from the National Parks website of White
Okay.
Sands National Park.
Okay.
And then I also have a little field guide from the state parks like DNR of New Mexico. So this species is called the White Sands pupfish. And
Oh yes, I'm so
I
excited. Oh, okay. Sorry.
was like thinking since we were talking about fish earlier, we could probably talk about some more fish.
Well, I was expecting a bird, so.
I have kept that feedback in my brain, and I
Mix
am trying to be more diverse of my
it up.
species.
Mix it
Yes.
up.
Yes. So if you're looking at these fish from an aerial point of view, they blend in with the bottom, the water bottom substrate. Yeah. And they're like a tan, like darkish yellow, brown, spotted kind of fish. Yeah. So it says, it may seem strange to associate fish with a desert environment, but not long ago, I guess, a large salt lake, now known as Lake Otero, which we talked about, once filled the Tularosa Basin. While there's speculation as to whether other aquatic life lived here at the time, one thing is certain, the only fish to survive the hydraulic and climatic changes over the last 12,000 years is the white sands pupfish. Found nowhere else in the world and listed as a threatened species by the New Mexico State Game Commission, the white sands pupfish is truly a unique little fish.
Yeah, they're teeny. They're related to sheep's head minnows.
Oh, yeah. Actually. I would say, like, yeah, they're a little minnow fish. Yeah. There are only four populations of white sands pupfish throughout the Tularosa Basin. On White Sands Missile Range, they are found in Malpais Spring, or Malpais, M-A-L-P-A-I-S, Malpais.
Malpais, probably.
Okay, yeah, I was saying, no, I'm definitely enunciating that wrong. So they're found in Malpais Spring, Mound Spring, and Salt Creek. The last population is in Lost River, which begins on Holloman Air Force Base and terminates just inside the northeast boundary of White Sands National Park. Each site is a microhabitat all on its own, ranging from deep spring-fed ponds to calm streams. A variety of plants such as saltgrass, salt cedar, pondweed, bulrush, cattail, and sedges grow along their edges. That sounded like a Dr. Seuss sentence. Sedges grow along their edges. water salinity varies from location to location, ranging from freshwater all the way to being saltier than seawater. Yeah. Despite these drastically different environmental conditions, the white sands pupfish is capable of not only thriving in their native habitat, but also quickly adapting should they find themselves displaced from one microhabitat to another. So going back to Jillian talking about anadromous fishes, this is an example of that because they can be in freshwater or saltwater.
And honestly, that checks out based on the fact that they're Cyprinodonte, which is the same as our coastal sheep's head minnows. The same, they look very similar too.
Yeah.
Because those fish are highly adaptable to salinity, which is not the case for every species. So that is very cool that you can see that also in a desert environment. Like, yeah, that's completely isolated from like the ocean. It's really cool.
Yeah. You're like, yep, checks out.
Yeah, I actually did my thesis work on not Cyprinodonte, but Fundulus, which is another similar kind of fish. Gotcha. The, like mummy chug, Gulf killifish, those kind of fish. They're found in marshes here. Mm-hmm. But so I know quite a lot about the fact that these fish can withstand incredible temperatures and salinities. They're like cockroaches. They're amazing.
Very adaptable fish.
Yeah, and they're very tiny.
Yeah. Yeah, they're so tiny. In fact, their sizes range from 1.75 to 2.5 inches.
It is teeny tiny. Cute.
That's like your thumb.
I know.
Your thumbnail, probably.
Ugh, babies.
And it's they're somewhat short and chunky looking, is what the National Park site website says.
Cute.
Which reminds me of just when we would sample together back at Vim's, and we'd just get like the mummy chog, and we're like, oh.
We're like, oh my goodness, look at him.
I remember the first time I heard you say that in that voice, and I was like, what the fuck is wrong with this girl? It's like, I was like, is she insane? And then, like, after a while, I was like, okay, no, she's not insane. She just really likes the teeny fishies.
They're just so sweet and small.
It definitely threw me for a loop, though. I was like, oh, God.
Oh, no, I know I weirded all of you out. But, like, honestly, like, I didn't start doing that until I watched our aquarium director, he baby talked fish.
Did he really? I never heard him baby talk fish. That's funny.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's like, you know, this very stoic kind of guy. But he would be like, oh. So I was like, oh, so even he does it. So I can baby talk anything it's I want.
Socially acceptable here. That's funny. I didn't know that about him. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're teeny chonks. That's what
Yes.
these pupfish
Tuna
are.
tonks.
Yeah. So mating season for them begins early April and lasts throughout the month of October. That's a long time. During this time, both males and females shift into bright color displays to attract potential mates. Ooh, they like the colorful dancing, huh? In males, what was a shimmering hint of blue iridescence along their body runs a bright metallic blue, while their fins and tail turn to a yellow orange. Their belly shifts from a silver white to a pale orange. And then females put on a similar display, turning bright greenish yellow with butter-colored fins. Is that similar to the fish you're thinking of too?
Wait, sheep's head? Yeah, the
Yeah.
males, I actually have some in my tank downstairs. The males have like a very bluey purple iridescence on their backs.
Cool.
And they are always fucking. They are all, I've so many eggs and babies. They all get eaten, of course, but like
Yeah.
they are constantly going at it. They are prolific little fish. So,
That's funny.
yeah.
Yeah, so it says while breeding, males establish territories for themselves, chasing off any other males who wander across their borders. They usually mate with several females over the course of a season. Females will lay several clutches of 12 to 15 eggs each during a single season. After hatching, the youngest fish grow rapidly, reaching a size to 1.75 inches within their first year and slowly increasing in size as they reach adulthood. The average lifespan of a white sands pupfish is 2 years. And as mentioned above, the white sand pupfish is currently considered a threatened species by the state of New Mexico. Protecting the water sources they inhabit is necessary for their continued survival. To that end, the New Mexico Department of Game and Fish and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, White Sands Missile Range, Holloman Air Force Base, and White Sands National Park all signed a cooperative agreement and conservation plan in 1994. This plan implemented general measures to maintain the current populations of the white sands pupfish and establish new ones in suitable locations in order to help this tough little survivor continue to thrive.
That's
So,
awesome.
yeah, that's the story of the white sands pupfish.
Okay, side note, if you're into sports, there is.
There's a little baseball team. I saw that when I Googled the images.
Yes, there is a White Sands Pupfish baseball team, which I fucking love.
Isn't that cute? I love
We
that too.
need to have more mascots like this. Why are we naming pe things after like racist stereotypes of people when we could have pupfish or like the Richmond Flying Squirrels? Remember
Yeah.
when that happened?
I do remember when that happened.
That's a great mascot.
We should start a petition to rename every sport team to a threatened or endangered
Yes.
conservation species.
That is why I do not care about football, but I was so mad that they had the opportunity to name the Redskins instead of
Something better than the Commanders.
the Red Wolves.
Or the, yeah, oh my God, the
That
Red
would be, it
Wolves.
would keep with the color scheme. It's an
Yeah.
endangered animal, a very endangered animal that is specific to like North Carolina, Virginia, and it has the same like Redskins, Red
Red
Wolves.
Wolves, yeah.
And now
And
we're
like
the
wolves are,
Washington football team. Like, fuck off.
yeah. Though and wolves are like intense. They're like,
Yeah.
apex
Yeah.
predator.
Could have
Like,
had, it would have been a great mascot. No one else is the Wolves in the NFL.
no. Wow. Jillian,
Right?
you should write a strongly worded letter to them.
Like, idiotic. Idiotic. Pisses me
Yeah.
off. Wasted opportunity. So when
They
I
really
see,
did. Honestly,
yeah.
I mean, I think about it. Like if major sports teams change their names to like threatened or endangered conservation species, like and then they make millions and billions of dollars per year. So then,
Yeah.
you donate back to a cause that,
Yes.
helps these animals.
And then you look good. But
Yeah,
also,
and it's tax write-off.
you don't have a stupid mascot. And the
Yeah.
colors make sense.
Yeah.
So when I see things like the White Sands pupfish as a baseball team, I'm just like, this is amazing. This is
That's
great.
nice.
I
Yeah,
love
we
it.
like
Yeah.
that. Yeah.
It's so cool and goes back to all my, because I always joked about how like all these like killifish, pupfish species are like little cockroaches. And it's like, that's the last survivor of that lake ecosystem that we talked about.
Yeah.
You know? That was
Well, and
prehistoric.
Yeah, I mean, this is the only place in the world that these fish live.
Yeah.
So, like, that's pretty special.
And
You
they've,
should
because they've been
take care.
isolated for so long that they've been able to speciate, I guess, which is
Yeah.
so cool. I love desert pupfish. There's just several species of pupfish because there's one in Death Valley as well that
Oh,
literally
really?
only
That's
live
cool.
in one cave system.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which is
That's really
so,
neat.
and because of that, like they can't develop those areas.
Yeah.
Love it. Pupfish out there doing the Lord's work.
Really, honestly, 2 inches at a time.
That could be skewed really inappropriate if I wanted it to be.
Yeah, no, I knew.
This was actually a pretty feel good episode for the most part, more so than they usually can be. But do you want to do happy things?
Yeah, we can do happy things for sure. Life's pretty good. So happy thing is just that life's pretty good, I guess. I have nothing really to pick out. I guess my happy thing would be that this is Alex's last trip for his
Yeah.
program, so he's going to be home more, which is great. Super proud of him of all that he's accomplished. So he never listens to this, but if anybody else listens to this, like, just give him a high five if you see him, or a hug, that'd freak him out even more.
It's okay. Corey doesn't listen either, but he's been on the show like three times
Yeah. Corey covers for me when I'm sick,
Yeah.
so that's what that is. Yeah, so yeah, Alex is driving back from the Space Coast. He went to the Space Center yesterday.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so he was learning all about what the law enforcement up there does, and apparently there is a lot of like waterfowl hunting up there
Okay.
on the Space Coast. So he learned a lot about ducks, and then like their field day, he was on an airboat trying to find like illegal hunting around that
Okay.
area. That's kind of what he was doing
Yeah.
this last week.
Yeah.
But this is his last trip, so he'll be home more, and he's like kind of completed the program. So I mean, that's a happy thing. I
Yeah.
had like so many people come work on the house the other day, and I was like home alone, and then it's always icky, you know, when it's like you're home alone, you've had like three different contractors come to the house. They know you're
Yeah.
alone. Like,
Yeah.
I don't know. I just don't like that feeling. So it's nice to
I get that.
have him back and help out with those types of things.
Yeah. Corey and I are about to launch into probably our busiest season, because I'll have two overlapping field projects, and gillnet season starts
Oh, fun.
in a week. Yeah, a
Yeah.
week. So it's gonna be fun. But I guess my happy things are, I got my garden all in, all my veggies.
Oh, nice.
So we're waiting on them to produce. We'll see how that goes. It's gone pretty well most years, so we'll
You got
see.
a good green thumb.
Yeah. Sometimes
I
it
think
depends
you
on the
do.
plant. It depends on the
Yeah.
plant, really.
Okay.
Because I cannot keep succulents alive to save my life. And
Really?
squash and I don't get along. So I don't know. But tomatoes, I can do tomatoes. I can do peppers.
Yeah.
But so far, all I've harvested are strawberries. So we're still waiting. But also, I have been able to forage a ton of wild dewberries recently, which are basically like
What's a dewberry?
tartar, they're like blackberries, but they're like native to
Oh.
down here.
Okay.
They've got kind of a more floral taste to them than I would say blackberries do. But they're
Gotcha.
still sweet when they're ripe, so they're very good. And so
Nice.
I found a bunch of them at one of my sites of
Yeah.
my where I have my eel ramps set up to catch American eels. But the slopes of the river and the creeks are like covered in
Oh.
dewberries. So I'm gonna get a bunch. I'm gonna make a cobbler. I'm gonna infuse some vodka. I might make some simple syrup. I'm like super excited.
Ooh, that's fun.
And I so like to this year is like the first year I'm like, I'm gonna do some wild foraging because I also want to make like prickly pear jelly because we have so many prickly pears down here and they're
Yeah.
all flowering right now. So
That's
I'm like,
nice.
I'm gonna get some fruit. I'm excited.
I got a lime shrub the other day, a couple weeks ago, and like a week later, it had a flower on it. So I have a little itty bitty lime growing on there, and I got more flowers on it. So I was like, cool, it's like
Yeah.
working. Yeah. Already, which is nice. So I'm excited about that.
It's exciting when it works because you're like, wow, I'm just like being one with the earth, my hands in the soil and producing food for myself, you
I
know?
know. I would love to just have, like, once all the other house renovations are done, I'm gonna get a raised bed and I'm gonna just put some, like, yeah, tomatoes, peppers, what have you,
Yeah.
in
And
there.
start small and build on each year because
Yeah.
that's kind of what I've been doing. And I just get bigger and bigger every year.
Yeah. And then, like, my neighbor's big into gardening, and his papaya tree, one of the branches is like over the fence into our yard. And there's like a couple papayas growing on that. So I told Alex, I was like, babe, we're gonna have papayas. Like, it's so great. He's like, those aren't ours. I was like, yes, if the branch is in our yard and the fruit's in our yard, those are ours now. Like, that's how that works.
I mean, they fall where they fall, you know. Just saying.
Excuse me.
That's
Yeah.
yeah, that's great. Yeah, because you can grow like tropical fruit and stuff down there. Wish we can do citrus, but it takes a while for citrus to produce, so we
Yeah.
haven't done it. But so that's my happy thing.
Nice.
Let me do my citations because I did not do them last week.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, did you not? I didn't even notice.
No, we
Whoops.
didn't. I'll start with Fossilized Footprints, White Sands National Park. And The First Americans by Glenn Hodges for National Geographic, January 2015. We have Naya Hoya Negro from the Hoya Negro website that just talks about the sea note and all the stuff involved. And then Ancient Bones Reveal Tough Life, A Girl's Tough Life in Early Americas by Tracy Watson from Nature. And then we have Fossilized Footprints Found in New Mexico, Traveler with Toddler in Tow by Olivia Gershon from the Smithsonian Magazine, and then Matthew Bennett et al., 2020, Walking in Mud, Remarkable Pleistocene Human Trackways from White Sands National Park in New Mexico. And that is from Science, that journal. So we actually used some scientific journals to do the research today, which was cool.
Nice.
And that's all my sources for today.
Love it.
All
Well, if
right.
you guys want to find us on the internet, we're on TikTok now at MNK or MNWK podcast. And we're also on Instagram, Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast. We have a website, mothernaturewillkillyoupodcast.com. We have a Facebook now. Is that Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast as well?
It's just Mother Nature would kill you. I forgot about
Oh,
the
that's fine.
That's
Jillian
fine.
does the Facebook. I do the TikTok. She also does the Instagram. And then, yeah, she also does the website. She does a lot. And what else am I forgetting? We're on all streaming platforms. So Google, Spotify, Apple, what have you. Tell your
Yeah.
friends. Tell a
Yeah.
story. We're open
Yeah.
to stories.
Yeah. So, also, if you are a prehistoric human being and you want to tell us how your survival is going, you can always send us a message. But if you haven't experienced, you know, the most intense of human survival, you can still send us your messages and your stories if you have experienced something just uncomfy while you've been out in nature, whether it be like, you know, a lightning storm, or maybe you got lost for a little bit out on the water, or you know, maybe you were stuck in a snowstorm somewhere. We still want to hear about it. And you can send us those stories on our website. We have a story submission section, or you can send it to our Gmail, which I believe is Mother Nature Will Kill You Podcast at gmail.com. If you want to help out the podcast, but you don't have any money because we live in a capitalistic hellscape, you can give us a 5-star review on any of our listening platforms to help bump us up that algorithm, or you know, like our TikToks and Instagram reels, stuff like that is helpful as well. Yeah. I think that's it.
Yeah, well, until next time, stay safe.
Most of all, stay curious, explorers.
See you later.
Bye.